For the roughly 200,000 Mexicans and those of Mexican descent living in the Philadelphia area, these are anxious times. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The Trump administration appears to be taking a hard line on immigration, and is preparing for construction of a wall along more miles of the southern border. Meanwhile, Philadelphia officials have continually offered support to Latin Americans, even those here illegally, by only helping federal immigration officials when they present a warrant. That uncertainty has led scores of Mexicans to seek advice and other support at the Mexican consulate in Philadelphia. I stopped by the consulate this morning with NewsWorks Tonight producer Shai Ben-Yaakov to get the lay of the land. Shai takes it from here.
It's Monday morning, and at least 100 people are crammed into the consulate's public area, a long, narrow hallway of a room where Mexican nationals can get their passports renewed, get pro bono legal advice, and get powers of attorney enforced. Volume is especially high today as a group seated at the end of the hallway listens to the consulate's annual presentation on financial literacy. One of the presenters is Paul D'Souza, an executive account manager at RK Financial Services in Doylestown. D'Souza was born here but raised in Brazil. He's fluent in Spanish. He says those who are undocumented are always apprehensive about opening accounts and signing paperwork, but things have gotten worse since the new administration came to power.
The concern is uncertainty. Do I do something? When do I do it? Do I do it here in America, or do I wait until something happens, you know, for me to start planning?
D'Souza says he advises everyone to act now, even if that means leaving assets behind.
Never push to the future. And even if something happens, you know, and that you may not stay in this country.
Some visitors to the consulate seem to have made up their minds that the new administration will be a hostile one, and that America may no longer hold the promise of success for them it once did. Seated near the back of the room is Jose Angel Perez. He's been in the country for 9 years and is here to get a passport to fly back to Mexico. I asked him why he was going back. He says he needs to go back to Mexico because his son is really sick. I asked if he's nervous about being able to get back to the United States. With a resigned look on his face, he tells me everyone is afraid and that he is too. He says he doesn't think he'll be able to come back, and adds that maybe he doesn't even want to. I'm Shai Ben-Yaakov, WHYY News.
I got the chance to talk over some of those concerns with Alicia Kerber, Philadelphia's head consul. The consulate, like others across the country, recently opened a legal defense center to answer questions from concerned Mexicans.
And yeah. So we've come upon you on this Monday morning, and we walked in for the first time very busy, and so we didn't know if it was in response to concerns about immigration policy, but describe the program that's underway this week.
We, in daily basis, we serve around 200 people every day that come to receive legal information or passports of Mexican IDs, but since the new administration took place, the number has duplicated, and now we are receiving around 400 people every day. Our telephones are ringing all the time. We receive messages through internet, through Facebook, through Twitter. So we need to be very active in these days.
And toward that end, you've established a specific legal defense center.
All the 50 consulates that Mexico has in the United States had opened this center for defense. So we are going to provide legal advice to all our nationals, but also we are going to give them information regarding what they can do, what they cannot do. Don't fall in any provocation. Don't react in a rush situation. Be calm. See all the scenarios that you have, and if you want to return to Mexico, we'll be more than happy to help you.
In a preemptive sense, what advice do you offer? I know among the things I read was the importance of having a power of attorney.
Yes, we are advising our community to be prepared. What does that mean? Prepare a power of attorney to know who are going to take care of your kids, or maybe who can take care of your car or sell your car, or who is going to take care of your house, or all your belongings, who is going to be responsible in case you are deported, but mainly who is going to take care of your kids, because as you know, many of those kids have been born here in the United States, So what is going to happen with them if their parents get deported?
What are some other prudent things that you advise people
to
do who
have
come
a bank
here with
account?
Concerns?
It's important for them to have a bank account, because otherwise if they don't have... They usually keep their money at home, and that's why, for example, today we are opening the week of financial education to let them know, don't keep your money with you, because otherwise lots of people of organized crime are really on them, so to take them their money. So open a bank account. We have agreements with several banks where you can open a bank account by just showing your matricula consular, your Mexican ID. So that's how we are working with them. If they have a bank account, then they can make international transfers in a very safety situation. Otherwise, if you bring your money with you, maybe you won't be able to pass it through Mexico, because there's a limit of the amount of money you can cross freely to another country. We are giving that information. We are giving them information of about a very specific program that Mexico has created that is called Somos Mexicanos. That program allows them to know about schools for their kids, about how to obtain a job in Mexico, about health services. Any type of information that they will require is going to be put in this program if they decide to come to Mexico or if they get deported. I think that the most important thing is to really highlight that Mexicans are people that really are honest people, are working people, and are not criminals, that we must not target immigration with criminal activity. That's something that really I want to highlight.
Quite frankly, is it frustrating that you even have to voice that, that it isn't obvious? Is it a measure to the extent to which we've become so, that immigration has become such a polarizing issue that you even have to say those words?
Yeah, I think that are the times that we are living now, but we must not fall in the situation when we think that, I don't know, telling at least this that didn't happen. We must not fall in that. We must continue fighting for human rights. Human rights must move forward and not backwards. So that's why we are committed on that in the Mexican government.
You can hear more of my conversation with Philadelphia's head consul of Mexico, Alicia Kerber, at newsworks.org. Philadelphia's public schools are in need of more than $4 billion in repairs. WHYY's Katie Culinary reports that district officials have a new plan to chip away at that to-do list with energy efficiency projects.
Compared with many public schools in Philadelphia, Lankenau High School in Roxborough is in pretty good shape. But the cinder block building isn't well insulated, and the old thermostats don't always send heat where it needs to go. So if you're a student in room 214, be sure to grab a sweater.
The teacher here also mentioned that there are times when the classroom is so cold that they're actually moving the class to another part of the building.
Emily Shapira heads the Philadelphia Energy Authority, a city agency. The city's more than 300 public school buildings are riddled with problems like these. To fix them, the district plans to contract with a company that will guarantee it can save the district energy, doing things like replacing old boilers, windows, insulation, and roofs with new, more efficient ones. Shapira says over time, the district will pay for these projects with lower energy bills.
This brings new capital to the forefront that costs the district nothing more than what they pay now.
The district will pilot the plan in three schools starting this fall. Superintendent William Height says the goal is to cut the district's energy bills in half.
And actually then use those savings to make investments in other places to take care of the $4.5 billion in deferred maintenance needs that we have now.
Height says the plan could save the district $600 million over the next 20 years. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Social workers and therapists are there for those who are struggling. But what happens when the very ones who provide support start to feel burned out? From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Anne Hoffman reports on the challenge of helping caregivers before they quit.
A therapist named Karen, who asked not to use her last name, recently noticed big changes in herself. She's worked with tough cases, everything from abused children to patients with drug addictions.
Before, I always kind of prided myself being pretty, like, on top of things, you know? Like, I was very structured in my everyday life. If I wanted to do something, I would, like, do it.
But then, after seeing the same patients come back through a program again and again and not getting support from her job, Karen started questioning what good she was doing. She says she felt stuck in a toxic cycle where she worked.
Where I just started to feel like a cog in the wheel. Like, the patients feel like they're not getting adequate care, and, like, the staff feels like they're not getting adequate care from the people, you know, the higher-ups. And the higher-ups are like, well, we don't have enough, and we need to remember that we're trying to make a profit here.
Soon, Karen wasn't sleeping well, even after taking an Ambien or some melatonin, sometimes both. During her waking hours, she started to feel like she was on autopilot.
I just started, like, coming home every day and just sitting on the couch and, like, sometimes not even, like, watching TV or reading. I'd just, like, sit there, or, like, I would start crying out of nowhere.
A social worker named Joanna, who also didn't want to use her last name, has a similar story.
On days when I would come home, being burned out already, I would have to go to bed at like 8 o'clock at night because I just had nothing left.
She also struggled with feeling like she had to be on all the time.
I wasn't good at turning my phone off at 5 o'clock. I wasn't good at seeing the phone ring and being able to just say, you know what? Somebody else is on call, they can handle it. I would jump to, and I would let that encroach on my personal time that I could have been spent doing self-care and taking care of myself.
Both women expressed feeling so down that it was hard to think it could get better.
I was finding that not doing any kind of self-care, I couldn't figure out what I needed. And because I couldn't figure out what I needed, I didn't try to ask for help. And so it was a really scary place to be in.
I think, like, the hardest thing about burnout is, like, that sense of, like, what you believe about the world is, like, shifted. You become this, like, very bitter person who, like, thinks that, like, the world is, like, inherently evil and bad.
Ida Kaufman, a field director at the Master of Social Work program at Penn School of Social Policy and Practice, says that's one of the hallmarks of vicarious trauma.
If you're listening to stories of trauma all day, every day, or you're exposed to communities where the impact of trauma is really front and center, after a while, the way the brain and the body works is you internalize some of those experiences, and you begin to react as if you have been traumatized yourself.
Kaufman also prefers to talk about compassion fatigue more than burnout. She says compassion fatigue isn't something that can be cured with a relaxing trip to wine country. She says it carries a host of physical problems like stomach issues and insomnia.
It really can, after a while, just be untenable. Either people kind of check out as a way of coping, or sometimes they're really smart and they do leave their job. Other times, they just sort of power through it, and then it looks kind of like what we would call someone who's pretty jaded.
She tells social workers to think deeply about self-care, and she's not talking about getting a manicure on a Sunday afternoon.
I always say, listen, I am not going to be the person who's going to stand up here and talk about bubble baths.
She talks about it in three ways. One, self-care related to one's personal life. Two, self-care related to one's job. And three, self-care on the agency level, meaning what is someone's agency doing to promote an environment that avoids burnout? Laura Krawchuk runs retreats for professionals in the helping field. She's also a social worker. She says that third area can be tricky.
The big X factor that we can't control for is that organizations sometimes aren't healthy. Sometimes the budget means that the workload is overwhelming.
She says healthcare in general has become increasingly stressful. Sometimes her retreat offers vital solace for people to go back and do their work. And sometimes a retreat isn't enough.
Other people realize I am in the wrong place. I need a change.
A year ago, Karen decided she needed to get out.
When I just, like, was in such a bad mood that, like, I just was, like, scowling all day. And, like, in my groups, it just really felt like I was just going through the motions.
She started saving money gradually and recently handed in her resignation. With time and distance, Karen says she realized that she wants to take some time off and eventually transition to a more flexible role. She credits a supportive supervisor with helping her to figure that out. As for Joanna, taking better care of herself has made a difference. Instead of bubble baths, she's nourishing her creativity.
I am in a writing group. I sing in my car, and even if it doesn't sound great, it feels amazing.
And she's adopted stronger boundaries. She used to pick up her phone no matter what.
In the past years, I've managed that a lot better. So the phone goes off.
Now she says it doesn't have to fall just to her. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art is the subject of a new artwork at another museum. The Fabric Workshop and Museum in Chinatown commissioned an artist to make a work examining the curatorial practices at the art museum. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports the work poses the question, what is art?
The Philadelphia Museum of Art has one of the largest collections of work by Constantine Brancusi, including a piece called Sculpture for the Blind, and it caught the eye of artist Lenka Clayton because it's displayed inside a glass case. It cannot be touched.
The quite understandable logic of a museum to keep the artwork safe collides with the logic of the artist or the title of the artwork to create this beautifully absurd situation of a sculpture for the blind that exists only for the sighted.
In response, Clayton gathered together 17 blind people, described to them as best she could what Sculpture for the Blind looks like, and asked them to recreate it based on their understanding of the piece. The original is an egg-shaped object about the size of a rugby football. The resulting 17 interpretations are now on display at the Fabric Workshop and Museum.
You can touch all of them.
While Clayton was researching the Brancusi sculpture, she came upon a letter in the archives written to the art museum in the 1970s. It was from a man who said his great-grandfather sculpted an egg similar to Brancusi's. So why is Brancusi's egg worthy to be in a museum, but his great-grandfather's egg is not?
Very poignant 40-year-old letter. I did some research, and I found out that it was never answered.
Clayton sent that letter to 1,000 museum directors and curators and asked them to provide an answer. 179 replies came back, ranging from the very curt to the very whimsical. This question of why some objects are considered art and some not is one museums grapple with every day. The answer is always changing, and it's sometimes confrontational, says John Vick, project manager at the art museum.
You have art lovers, and then you also have like art skeptics, and skepticism makes you think more. It makes you look more closely. It makes you do all the things that can lead to an experience of art that is very rewarding.
The installation at the Fabric Workshop and Museum and the Art Museum's recent response to it will be on display until July. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
We are just about 12 hours past equinox. Let's put a finger on the balance scale with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, sunrise, sunset, with a 12-hour gap in between, right?
Almost. Pretty close. The word equinox, of course, leads us to believe that, in fact, we'll have equal hours of daylight and darkness when we come to these two points at the traverse of the Earth around the sun for the course of the year. There's the vernal equinox, which is where we are now, and the autumnal equinox, which is where we'll arrive in another few months.
So what happened at 6:29 this morning?
Well, at 6:29 this morning, a couple of things happened, really. The Earth arrived at a point in its orbit around the sun where the rotational axis of the Earth allows for us to have equal hours or nearly equal hours of daylight and darkness. If we translate this into a geocentric view of the sky looking up, what this means is that the sun, as it crosses through the sky that day, is crossing right over the Earth's equator.
So the fudge factor is our latitude in the Philadelphia region.
There are actually many fudge factors that go into this. Latitude is one of them. So for this day to be exactly equal hours of daylight and darkness, we'd actually have to be at the equator to make that happen. The farther away we get, the other things begin to creep in. Things like the fact that we count this date as being the point when the center of the sun appears in such a place as it rises above the horizon, whereas sunrise and sunset are when the first point of the sun comes above the horizon. And then there are other sort of idiosyncrasies and discrepancies, like the fact that the Earth's atmosphere acts somewhat like a lens. So we actually see the sun rising above the horizon before it's actually above the horizon. So the sun's not quite there yet. But the difference isn't that much when you count it all the way. It's just that the word itself connotes that wherever you are on the planet, well, you're going to have these equal hours of daylight and darkness.
Equilibrium at the equator. What's happening at the poles?
The day of equinox for the North Pole and the South Pole is a really strange thing because both experience what you could sort of describe as all day, sunrise, sunset, sort of like twilight. So theoretically, what you have is the sun orbiting above the Earth's celestial equator. If you're at the North Pole, that puts the sun right down at the horizon. North or South Pole puts the sun right at the horizon. Okay? So for that day, you'd have the sun going all the way around the horizon. Okay? Now, as we move from equinox, if we're looking at the northern hemisphere, what's going to begin to happen, of course, is as the Earth continues its motion around the sun will appear to rise higher and higher in the sky on each successive day. So at the North Pole, you'll begin to get that 24 hours of full daylight with the sun well above the horizon. If we go down to the South Pole, though, we'll have the exact opposite effect, where the sun is now below the horizon, giving extended periods of darkness for entire days.
Derek, on Nights with Clear Skies this week, what's available to be seen in the night sky?
We've been tracking Venus for quite some time in the evening sky since last fall, right through the winter and now into the spring. However, Venus is quickly disappearing from the evening sky, setting into sunset. But it's exchanging places with Mercury. So as Venus gets lower in the sky just after sunset, Mercury pokes its head up above the horizon. You'll need binoculars to catch it, but it will appear as a bright pinpoint of light. But give the sun a chance to get down below the horizon as the sky is darkening before you take a shot for this one. We don't want to be looking too close to the sun. But in the meantime, over in the eastern sky, 10 p.m., Jupiter is well up in the east. And for those of you that are up early in the morning, before 6 a.m., 5:45 in the south and the southwest, you'll find Saturn in the south and Jupiter brightly shining over in the southwest.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.